This is Cade Courtley, former Navy SEAL, sniper, and platoon commander. I've seen what happens when the lights go out, and after Hurricane Helene left 4 million Americans in the dark for days, I'm giving you the same advice I give my own family. Get backup power now. So to celebrate July 4th, get the best-selling Patriot Power Generator, 2200X with a free mini generator to charge your smaller devices. That's double the solar power, absolutely free. Because as a SEAL, I learned two is one and one is none. You'll recharge twice as fast for true power independence. This generator will run your fridge, charge every phone in your house, keep critical medical devices alive, all without a drop of gas or deadly fumes. Get $100 off if you're a senior or veteran like me and take a full year to pay. Why such a crazy deal? Because July 4th is our holiday and you deserve it. This sale ends July 7th. Go to 4patriots.com. That's the number 4patriots.com. Don't wait, get peace of mind.
Picture this. The power goes out, your phone's at 50%, and suddenly your home is cold, dark, and you can't cook a thing. Oh, and it's the middle of winter. It's freezing. Cold air creeping in, and you, wrapped in blankets, hoping the heat kicks back on. Well, not anymore. Meet the new Patriot Power Generator 2200X from 4 Patriots, our biggest solar generator ever, built to keep your essentials running through winter storms, rolling blackouts, ice outages, whatever hits next. It turns on automatically when the power goes out, can run a full-size fridge for up to 3 days, and arrives fully charged, so you're ready the moment the lights go out. And right now, for the first time ever, you'll get a free 200-watt solar panel. And once this batch is gone, it's gone. Visit 4patriots.com, that's the number 4patriots.com, and claim your 2200X solar generator and free 200-watt solar panel while this holiday offer lasts.
Colonel Rob Manis has a lifelong record of providing dedicated service to this nation. Having worked his way up from the enlisted ranks to full colonel, he served our country for more than 32 years. He has served as a bomber squadron commander, bomb disposal technician, Joint Chiefs of Staff Operations Officer, assisted the National Security Team with the campaign plan for the global war on terrorism. He authored the first theater nuclear war plan, and served as the vice commander of America's largest airborne intelligence wing. Colonel Rob Manis is a true American hero. This is Rob Manis Live.
I think we had a really great meeting, and we're very proud of the party here. We like everybody really in the room. I don't like a few people, but that's okay. I think you know who they are. But I'll give you that information someday. But for the most part, we have a really well-unified party. And I said it very strongly. We have the hottest country anywhere in the world. We're the most powerful. We're the smartest. We're the most respected. 2 years ago, we were a laughingstock all over the world. We had a terrible group of people represented us. Every leader, I just left G7. Every leader, and we had a lot of people in addition to G7, as you know, came. Everyone said, what we've done in a year and a half is a miracle.
Friends, welcome back to the Rob Manis Show on Truth Thursday today, and we're live on Worldview 2 and our X Spaces simulcast. Well, you just saw President Trump laying into Senate Republicans, calling out the rhinos, making it clear he's fed up with the dysfunction in that chamber. Every clip you'll see today is from that chamber or about it. The frustration is real, and it's not just about one meeting or one single bill. It goes very much deeper. The United States Senate was never designed to be just another popularly elected body like the House of Representatives. The founders created it as a deliberative body to represent the sovereign states that were part of the compact of the U.S. Constitution, with senators chosen by state legislatures, not by direct popular vote. That structure was meant to protect federalism, to check federal power, and keep the Senate focused on the long-term interests of the states. But in 1913, 17th Amendment changed all that. And since then, senators have become more responsive to national donors, party leaders, and the D.C. machine than to the states and the people of those states they're supposed to represent. The result is exactly what we're seeing today: gridlock, broken promises, and a Senate that often feels completely disconnected from the American people, and most importantly, from the Constitution of the United States. Well, my guest today has been digging into this issue for years. He's a highly respected attorney who specializes in investigating public corruption and racketeering, the same kind of institutional failures we see in Arizona and across the country. He's currently a graduate student and researcher in public administration, and he's teaching political science. He's the co-author, along with James R., of this new book, Restoring the Senate, John Thaler. John, welcome back to the Rob Manis Show.
Thank you, Colonel. It's so good to be with you today.
Yeah, man. I tell you what, I'm excited to see the book. Finally, somebody has written about this issue in enough detail that maybe it will get through some people's heads that what happened in 1917 was probably one of the worst wrong turns the United States has ever had. Am I right?
Oh, you're absolutely right about that. And I think one of the impetuses for the book was not just that James R. and I would talk about this on the air, but you have this very strong movement today from all over the country of people wanting to abolish the Electoral College. And what they don't understand at all is obviously why there is an Electoral College, what it does, why it's so important. But they don't understand that the entire formation of the Constitution was underpinned by this, that you had several different ways by which the states would check the powers. One is, of course, the Electoral College. The second one is that senators were not voted on by the people, but were selected in whatever process the legislature of each state chose. And then the third, of course, which is one we don't even think about that much, is that if you're going to change the Constitution, the state legislatures have a say in that. So those were the three safeguards that Madison put into the equation to ensure that the states had rights and that the federal government couldn't take them over. Well, you know, when you got to the turn of the century and you got, you know, I've talked about this before. I think one of the most fascinating periods of our history is the McKinley era. And it's because it is the age where we really get into the Industrial Revolution. It's where railroads are going across country for the first time. It's where oil starts to become very important. It's the beginning of the combustion engine and, of course, cars. And so you finally had, you know, what we call today billionaires and trillionaires, but that's when you first started having millionaires. And if you go back in time, the comments that are being made, the negative comments being made against Musk are the same comments that were made against Rockefeller and others, that they were going to somehow destroy our society. So you had lots of money in politics. Remember, and this is, I think, very important, you didn't have an income tax or barely had an income tax back then. So everything you did was at the state level, including your taxes. And corruption ensued, which, you know, happens anytime you have money in politics. And it got so bad that states like Delaware at one point couldn't even seat a senator for almost a 2-year period. And so in the wisdom of the populace, they said, well, this is horrible. There's these millionaires controlling everything. We'll let the people decide. And they passed the 17th Amendment. And they decided that from now on, you're going to vote for your U.S. senator. And I would bet you if you took a poll of, say, graduating college students today and you asked them if they even knew what the 17th Amendment was, they would tell you they have absolutely no idea. It's not taught, as are many other things, but it's not taught. So the foundations that made this country and made the Constitution what it is have been entirely bypassed by education. And the result is that you have these comments constantly on X and other places. I mean, just spend 5 minutes on MS Now, and they will tell you they need to abolish the Electoral College. Well, like I said, that would be the second domino, and just wait till amending the Constitution doesn't go to the states anymore. It's really, really tragic that we don't know these things and that we don't at least examine what the cause and effect was. Prohibition was easy. Oh, wait, I can't drink. Let's get rid of this. I want to drink my alcohol. But you don't really know from things like the 17th Amendment what the effects are because nobody's really ever studied them. So James and I tried to do it here to give a history, to give a background, to kind of also make it fun because we think it's such an interesting time in our history. But also, if we did repeal it, what would happen?
Yeah. I mean, this subject is not alone in that. I think, to be honest with you, the reason why we're not teaching our kids about the realities of things like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, more importantly, and everything that's come since then, whether it's right or wrong, is creating the problems you're seeing, not just in our government today, but on our streets. You know, the Civil War is one thing. Look, The Civil War didn't settle any questions. The question being, can a state that signed up voluntarily for the compact voluntarily leave if it sees the compact being broken in its judgment? That question has never been answered. You know, we were talking before the show about law, people doing things in practice and saying it's the law and what the law actually says. That's a common problem in this country. And I think that's why we don't teach it to our kids, because we don't want them to look back and see all these questions that remain unanswered. But some of them should remain unanswered, like this question of whether voters should select U.S. senators or not. So, John, in the book, you guys, one of the things you dive into is what's the reasoning behind the state legislature selecting senators versus what we've bangled it up to do?
That's a great question. Look, what people, I think, don't realize, again, because they don't understand federalism, is that the states actually originally controlled the United States separately and apart, of course, but they controlled the United States. And it was originally set up that way. The Articles of Confederation, which predate our Constitution, were designed specifically so that the states pretty much had all the power. The federal government had this very, very minimalist power. But it became very clear that we had two problems. One is we had interstate commerce. And you couldn't have each separate state regulating goods and services coming into their state or going out of their state. It's almost like what we have today with Iran saying, we're going to control the Strait of Hormuz and we're going to tax you. You can imagine if you had, and remember, there's 13 of them back then. We didn't have 50, but you had 13 separate territories all taxing separately and controlling shipping separately and mandating what can come in and out of the state and on and on and on. So there had to be some focus on the federal government. With the Constitution, remember, different than the Bill of Rights, with the Constitution going forward and an interstate commerce clause in there, there had to be a regulatory body to settle disputes between the states so that the country could run as a country. But at the same time, the states were absolutely, you know, apoplectic about the idea of federal power and the federal government somehow taking over and essentially what's happened today, starving them out. You know, we'll talk a little bit about the block grant problem and what it's led to. And of course, you know, the Leering Center and all these things because of how we've now put the power in the federal government and how we dole that back to the states. But the states were terrified of this, that the federal government was going to wind up having all the control and the power. And the only way you could get a balance out of the Constitutional Convention to get the Constitution passed was to have this balance where states had this check and balance on the federal government. So again, the Electoral College was part of it to make sure that heavy population centers didn't control the election. It was done by making senators come directly from the legislature. And of course, it was done by making sure that the states had to also pass any amendments to the Constitution. But the other deal was, and we don't think about it this way, but the federal government was supposed to be kind of the CEO of a corporation. And each state was expected to be a different division, if you will, of that corporation. So if the corporation is made up of divisions, which are the states, it's the states that are supposed to have the power. That's why you have two senators, not a proportion of senators. That's why the Senate has its own rules. That's why the Senate has its own way of doing things, even with the filibuster to a degree. All of this was designed to protect from a tyranny of the majority. And that's what we've lost. And of course, if you listen to the DSA, to you know the socialist candidates who just won in New York, that's exactly the opposite. They want to throw all of this out.
And if they throw all of this out, what happens?
Well, if they throw all of this out, what you have is a pure tyranny of the majority. States no longer would have any influence or any rights. And that's essentially what they're asking for. You know, beyond some of the kind of party jokes we make about socialism and communism, the real serious aspect of these people winning, of just not just Mamdani, who's a mayor, but of people going to Congress who have similar beliefs, is that ultimately what they want is they want majorities. They think they can get enough of the poor in this country, the people who are dependent on the system, to add to the system. This has been one of the things that we've talked about, I think, in history classes, you know, ad nauseum, is that the entire problem here is that once you vote yourself from the trough, you never give up the trough, and you keep voting more and more to be fed into it. And that's the theory. If we can put enough people on the dole, we'll get to a point where more and more people are dependent on the dole. They don't care about their states. They certainly don't care about their localities. They simply care what the federal government is going to provide to them. And that sets up an entirely different dynamic in this country, where states have no independent, not only independent authority, but, you know, an independent identity. You wouldn't be any different living, say, in California than living in Arizona, than living in Texas, than living in Florida. And that's the real tragedy that they simply don't understand.
Well, yeah, people are leaving California because they're going to Texas.
Correct, and to Florida, and to Arizona.
Florida. Quite often, though, they're bringing their communist baggage with them and trying to change those states.
This has been, as you know, a big problem, especially maybe a little bit in Texas, but absolutely in Arizona, where Arizona, that was a very solidly red state for a long time, for a number of years there, and of course in 2020, which went for Biden, I mean, outside of the fraud problem, obviously, that an election was even that close, that you have two Democrat senators, that you have a Democrat governor, a Democrat attorney general, a Democrat secretary of state in Arizona, is entirely because of two things: the illegal alien population shift, which happened especially under Biden, and because you have so many Californians taking California with them to states like Arizona. And that's essentially what the DSA is trying to do. They want to make California essentially, and what you see in Minnesota, the model for the country, and make it a nationwide set of issues rather than, hey, I'm in California, I don't like, you know, paying property taxes like I'm doing, income taxes like I'm doing, infrastructure problems, et cetera, highest cost of living in the country, I'm going to move. Well, now it doesn't matter if you move, because now everything is controlled by the federal government.
Yeah, and that inherently limits freedom of movement, not through government force, but through desire and choice. All right, we got to take a break, John. When we come back, I want to dive some more into the book, talk about the balance between democracy and deliberation. And we'll see a clip from one. It's about one of the senators that was in the meeting yesterday that President Trump was talking about at the end of the show. Another senator. We'll be right back with John Thaler, author of Restore the Senate, or co-author, I should say, along with James Arp.
At a certain age, you stop chasing younger. You start protecting what helps you feel steady, strong, and well. Your body's collagen matters. It supports the structure of your skin, joints, and connective tissue. But as the years go by, your body needs more support from the inside. That's where Bella Grace Elixir comes in. Bella Grace Elixir combines Verisol Collagen, the world's most clinically proven collagen, with Astereal Astaxanthin and Cat's Claw in a proprietary blend designed to help support the processes that reconstruct collagen, while also offering antioxidant and anti-inflammatory effects. And this isn't just for women. It's for men and women who want to age with more confidence, more care, and a daily wellness routine that supports the body from within. One simple elixir, thoughtfully formulated for whole body wellness. Take care of the body that has carried you this far. Order Bella Grace Elixir today at melissahousebg.com.
So, Lauren, take us behind closed doors. What happened inside that room?
Yeah, I mean, what we have heard from sources that were in that room and Senator Bill Cassidy himself is that this was an exchange that really escalated with the president. Bill Cassidy telling our colleague Morgan Rimmer just a few moments ago that he lost his temper. Essentially, the president was asking why these four Republican senators would vote for this war powers vote last night. And at that point, Cassidy told our colleague Morgan Rimmer that he asked the president, is that a rhetorical question, or do you want to actually know the answer? The president invited him to share why he voted the way that he did. And essentially, Cassidy berated the president for what has transpired in Iran, for not being clear with Congress about his actions in the region, and essentially arguing that until he got a more fulsome briefing of what was transpiring, he was going to continue voting the way that he was voting. Cassidy said that the president was raising his voice, and in response, he continued to raise his. He said he lost his temper, that he's not necessarily proud of that fact, but he joked it was the Irish in him. I mean, obviously, this was an extremely tense exchange. A lot of Republican senators coming out of that meeting noted that it had taken place. Some of them, Senator Tommy Tuberville, tried to downplay it to me, arguing that it was a really cordial exchange, that they were just having a difference of opinion.
Welcome back to the Rob Manis Show. It's Truth Thursday. We're talking the truth about the need to restore the Senate to its original function and what it's supposed to do. And now what that report left out from, I had an original clip that Cassidy's people, I think, took down because they were the ones that posted it, that had Bill Cassidy saying in the hallway why he was asking the question. He goes, well, I'm asking on behalf of all of the American people. Now, this is a United States senator from one state, one senator from one state. And I think that comment gets right to the heart of this issue, doesn't it, John?
Is exactly where the problem lies, is that senators were not supposed to be nationwide, either in the monies that they received to become senator or run campaigns or anything. I mean, we know, you know, about the money in politics. We know, you know, after, especially after Citizens United, how much money comes in. We know how much gets diverted through USAID and through all these NGOs that got created through Congress, especially through the Democrats. The idea of a senator was supposed to be a representative of the state. And that's why the state chose the representative. He is not supposed to be a senator for the American people. He is supposed to be a senator specifically representing his state of Louisiana. What do the people of Louisiana want? Obviously not what Bill Cassidy wants, because he just got his rear end thrown out. And that's the problem. And now what you're seeing is this kind of payback of I'm representing everybody. No, you're not. And even with the elections now being in the hands of the people, that still was never the point of this. This was always supposed to be I'm representing the people of Louisiana. I guess Bill Cassidy didn't get the memo.
He's not a very bright guy. Trust me, I'm very well, very familiar. One of the questions that comes to my mind, though, with this particular exchange is the bill, the resolution they were talking about, which ultimately was represented and failed because he flipped his vote, by the way, after getting told to sit down and being called a lunatic by the president. The Congress, the Senate being the key functioning organ for the states in the legislative process, abdicating its war powers to the executive branch. That's what this is all about. Why are they yelling at the commander in chief for doing the things that they've abdicated on?
Well, look, this is probably a whole other show, and it goes to, you know, my experiences in the Middle East and in Middle East politics. But I think with respect to how the Senate operates, it's a very good lesson in what happens when running for Senate becomes a national priority rather than a local one, a state one. Because again, if you're, you know, it's not that you're going to keep money out of the hands of the legislature. I mean, obviously, legislative members are going to run for election. They're going to get money. They might even say, and if you elect me, here's who I'm going to appoint as U.S. Senator. And they may even do that. But to the degree that you have all this national money coming in and that you're no longer running from a state, you're running, you know, from across the country. I mean, look at the Tallarico race. You know, look at Paxton and Tallarico. And it's not obviously the only example, but look at all that flood of money. You know, they're not running from Texas per se, even though it's Texas voters. They're running across the nation to get the donations to come in to be able to run. So, you know, how much influence Texans have anymore, I guess we'll see on election day, hopefully a lot to put Paxton in the Senate. But this is the problem. It was never supposed to be this way. The Texas legislature was supposed to decide who do we think best represents our interests in the U.S. Senate. who's going to do the most good for the state of Texas, who's going to represent our wishes and our desires. And that's not what you have anymore. And so, you know, this is what you get. You get four of these senators who, you know, no longer Cassidy, but the others who depend on cash coming in from across the country, not from a legislature choosing them, who now take the position, you know, based on popularity polls, oftentimes which are based on false information. And now that's what you get. You get people running for office who are running nationally and not locally. And it takes all of us, you know, in the particular state that we live in, out of the campaign. Even though we get the vote, it takes us kind of out of the campaign and certainly out of the selection process. Because now, especially in the primary process, outside money and outside influence is playing almost an exclusive role in who's even determined to run in November.
So say we turned back this the 17th Amendment and repealed it. Do we have any surviving records of how the senator selection was operated in practice by the states?
Yeah, we do. And what mostly happened back then is that there would be, you know, it was, I think of it as the House speakership election. It was very similar to that, where names would be nominated and put up for nomination. And then the legislature, unless it made it a separate set of rules, but for the most part, legislatures then combined, you know, usually you have two chambers of a state legislature, they would vote for the people, and they would have their own rules. Did you need a majority? Did you need a supermajority? Could you get a plurality if there were more than two candidates on the ballot? You know, each state had its own rules. But again, each state had its own rules. That was the beauty of this, that states could decide. And if you didn't like the rules, nowadays you could have a proposition on a ballot that changes the rules. You could have the legislature making changes to the rules, but you could make the rules make sense for your state. And then you would put people up for vote. They would get a vote. And as I said, one of the reasons it got, you know, this whole system got done and the 17th Amendment came into effect is because states like Delaware couldn't get anybody elected. So they would go through needing a majority, and they couldn't get a majority vote on a candidate. And this went on for 2 years. And it was one of the catalysts to put in the 17th Amendment in the first place. So, you know, yeah, that happens. But you know what? That's exactly how it was intended to work. If a state couldn't agree on somebody, if a legislature could not pick somebody to be a majority winner, just like we can't in the House of Representatives, guess what? You have no Speaker of the House. You have no U.S. Senator. That's precisely how it was intended to work. The founding fathers understood that you could have either corruption or you could just have disagreement, and you could have this happen. And you know what? Too bad for Delaware or California or anywhere else where this happens. Too bad. That is the system. That's how it works. And if you can't place somebody, then you can't. If you can't place a Speaker of the House, what happens? The House is not entitled to conduct any business. That's exactly the impetus to figure it out. States often did the same thing. If you couldn't put somebody in the seat, you have to figure it out because now you have no U.S. senators. So stuff did get resolved, but people wanted quicker resolution. They thought, oh, isn't it great if we democratize this? We are not, as we've said before, we are not a democracy, and we are not one for a very good set of reasons. This is how we prevent tyranny of the majority, is through these issues. Otherwise, that's exactly what you have. And as I said, as the federal government gains more power and provides more benefits to more and more people, what are people's fundamental interests? It's not losing your benefits, necessarily what's doing the best for your country or anywhere else. And so that's the problem you get into here.
Yeah, as Ronald Reagan said, and I'll paraphrase him, the closest thing to everlasting life outside of going to heaven is a government program, I believe, something to that effect. We've got a question in the audience. Let's go ahead and take that. Go ahead, Shel.
We have SJV, sir.
Thank you for taking my question, because it's something I'm passionate about. My understanding, the reason the Senate was designed the way it was to resist change. So, you know, the next fad comes along, does it totally change our government?
I couldn't explain it in a millisecond.
But the thing is, I see things getting worse I see even Republicans saying.
Next question for our guest, SJV.
Yeah, I say I see us getting worse by removing rules to make things easier done, and that's the big swing we see back and forth. How do we revert this? How do we get people to realize that Trump pushing through everything he can isn't the right way to go? Somehow we need to get back to compromise.
I would agree with you on this. Look, the idea, I think, certainly was, as it always was, to have a slow process. You know, that's why the deliberative nature of both even the House, but certainly of the Senate, was conducted the way it was, is that you weren't supposed to be able to pass legislation quickly unless there was an emergency. And the idea was, is that if you had a national emergency, people would get together because you have an emergency. But I'll give you a great example of the problems you get into with that is something like the Patriot Act, where we've had all sorts of freedoms that got taken away from us very quickly because of a national tragedy. We all agree on the tragedy. We all agree on how horrible it was. And we all agree on a need to prevent it from happening again. But we didn't realize very quickly how many of our rights were being, you know, cut, changed, taken away from us, minimized, et cetera. And, you know, people kind of said, okay, well, you know, this is okay with us. No, it's not. So the Senate was designed very particularly to be as slow a deliberative body as it could to make sure, again, that majority tyranny idea didn't come into play. So that just because the majority of Americans wanted something didn't mean it was going to happen, especially if it cut into that juxtaposition between the federal government and the states.
Yeah, unfortunately, though, the state's power has been so whittled away. Now we see the institution being used to disrupt the policies that President Trump ran on, that the people overwhelmingly voted him in a historic two of a kind reelection. But to disrupt the attempts to get the policies done, instead of taking the legislation challenge on and making it the best for the American people and getting stuff done, they're not doing it at all, or even obstructing his ability to do a recess appointment. Now, we've got to take a break right now, but we'll be right back with John Thaler talking about his and James R.'s new book, Restore the Senate.
Take a look at the water you just poured. It looks clean. It tastes fine. But what's really in it? Lead? Fluoride? Arsenic, chlorine, pesticides, PFAS forever chemicals, pharmaceutical residues, and bacteria. Every single day, these toxins flow straight from your tap into your glass, into your family. It's time for Century H2O from Worldview Water. Century H2O is the ultimate water treatment technology, designed to remove harmful toxins, balance your water's pH, and enrich it with essential minerals like calcium and magnesium, the way nature intended. From commercial-scale systems to whole-house filtration to crisp, delicious drinking water right at your kitchen sink and shower, Century H2O delivers cleaner, healthier water everywhere you need it. No plumber, no tools, no plumbing knowledge required. Perfect for homes, apartments, rentals, RVs, refrigerators, and more. Because everyone deserves access to clean, healthy water. Visit worldviewwater.net. That's worldviewwater.net.
It's the official. NBC News has now declared that the second spot in the June 27th Republican Senate runoff in Louisiana will go to State Treasurer John Fleming. So the runoff now is set. Congresswoman Julia Letlow, State Treasurer John Fleming, and that means that Senator Bill Cassidy, two-term Republican incumbent senator, who voted to convict Donald Trump in his second impeachment trial in January of 2021, has been defeated. He will be denied renomination, and he will become the first sitting Republican senator, elected Republican senator since 2012, to lose a primary, to be denied renomination by his party. Again, Letlow clearly leading here tonight. Fleming, though, now safely, securely in second place here. Cassidy in third. The runoff set for June 27th.
Welcome back to the Rob Maynard Show. It's Truth Thursday. We're talking about the new book, Restore the Senate, by Attorney John Thaler and his partner, James R., a political commentator. And I just had to show that clip, number one, just to show the very lackluster performance that a two-term senator had when a real closed primary election occurred, and he was soundly defeated, couldn't even get into the runoff. But two, that runoff is this coming Saturday on 27 June. Get out there, and Donald Trump endorsed Letlow in that race. So if you're listening to this and you're in Louisiana, remember that, June 27th, on Saturday, go vote. John, the other reason I showed that clip is that none of that should be even in play based on what we're talking about here. It should be the state legislature. Now, did any states just have the governor appoint their senators under the old system?
No, actually, the old system actually required that it be appointed by the legislature. The rules, as we talked about earlier, could be different from state to state, but it was the legislature that was in charge of doing so. So the idea was is that you still had a people's body and a deliberative body, not just a single person or anything, because then you just give all the money to the governor. The governor picks the person, you know, who probably gave him the most money, and that's who your senators would be. So the idea was is that this had to come from the entire deliberative body of the legislature, because those are the people who are closest to the citizens. That was the model. You know, people really, really, really forget, I think, that the model here was is that we vote for people to then represent us. And, you know, we have in our states, we have even smaller districts than what we have. You know, right now it's about 750,000 people per U.S. House seat, give or take. You know, for many, many states, you know, that can be as small as about 75,000, so maybe one-tenth. So the whole idea was is that you have these small deliberative bodies. You have, you know, local, you know, district captains, if you will. You know, you have, you know, an ability to meet the candidates, see the candidates, et cetera. In Colorado, a friend of mine who's actually the person who introduced me to James R., Jim Wiley, is running for Secretary of State. And the way in which he's doing it is to go to these small deliberative bodies and groups and to introduce himself and to talk about the issues in Colorado, which obviously have become a lot more famous. You know, voting issues here have become very famous lately, but to go and talk to them and meet with them. And this is how you meet the people. This is how you don't have that kind of starstruck distance between you and the person who's controlling, you know, what you do, what your life is all about. You actually are their friends. You're their neighbors. They understand you. You understand them. You all come from the same place. They get together in the state capitol, and they pick somebody who's going to best represent you. Now, is this without flaws? Absolutely, it's not. Nothing in politics is. But is this better than what you have now? Absolutely. And your example of Bill Cassidy, I think, is an exact example, probably quintessential, of what the problem is. If Cassidy were trying to run for a third term, he would never have gotten off the ground because the legislature would have said, yeah, you're not doing the job again. You're fired.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't doing what the state wanted him to do. How did the states transmit that to the senators when the senators were picked by the state legislature? Did they give them guidance?
Yes, they did. Yeah, they absolutely did. And in fact, you know, think of it this way. When congressmen, you know, people talk about congressmen being on breaks, they never work. Mm. But we both know that's absolutely false. You know, congressmen fly back and forth consistently from their districts. They meet, they have meetings in their districts. They meet with constituents. They meet with businesses. They meet with individuals. They find out what's going on in your life, and they go back to Washington and they do it. So the idea that somehow they're not doing any work simply because they're not sitting in Washington, well, some of us actually apply the fact that they're not doing the work in Washington. But the same thing with the Senate, but the difference was is the Senate didn't meet as much with constituents. They met with the legislature. So they would fly back or drive back or horse and buggy it back in the day to their state. And again, remember, when you only had 13 states and then, you know, 15 and 17, et cetera, you know, it wasn't like you had to come all the way to California yet. But when you went back to your home state, you basically met with your legislature and you talked about what the needs of the legislature were. Maybe they were passing a program that needed government funding. Maybe they needed something changed in interstate commerce. You know, maybe there was something in overseas commerce that they needed to be done. But the legislature could tell their Senate representative, the senator would go back to the U.S. Senate and try to accomplish it.
Well, that makes perfect sense. The guys that wrote the Constitution were pretty smart.
They were very smart.
What did they say in the Federalist Papers about this body?
They didn't talk about it that much in the Federalist Papers because there wasn't a discrepancy going on here. Nobody had an argument about this. In fact, it's almost the opposite, that the bigger deal was really in how you wrote the Constitution and what were the Article 1, 2, 3, 4 powers. That mattered more than how you had a Senate and a House, except for the fact that the Senate was going to be two-person. So every state, no matter what the size, the state of Wyoming, which has the least population, has one congressman, but has two senators. And that's why they have two senators, because, again, they're not representing the people of Wyoming. They're representing the legislature of Wyoming. So it went into that total package of federalism. It went into an electoral college. It went into electing the Senate, and it went into the ability of the states to have a say in amending the Constitution. That was the trifecta.
Oh, wow. All right, we've got another question from the audience. This is great. I like getting questions from the audience. Go ahead, Joe.
We have Joe Lanusa.
Hey, thank you. Longtime fan, Colonel Maness, first time caller. On the mumblings back in the mid 1800s, I think Delaware was one that went a couple of years or some time without being represented. But this culminated up into the, of course, post-Civil War, early 1900s. What were the arguments to take senators from being essentially the state government's representative to be the people's in a state, the population in a state's representative? What were some of the arguments that, because this was a constitutional amendment, they had to convince the people. What were the arguments at the time, do you know?
The biggest argument was corruption. The biggest problem that existed then, and I was talking about this a little bit earlier, is that you have to remember, up until 1913, when this passed, states were in charge. You didn't have a federal income tax system like you have today. So all of your money that was paid in taxes was on property taxes, sales taxes, and income taxes to the states. So what was happening was that the states were corrupt. States were getting what you see now is happening to the federal government. Look, power, money goes to where the power is, and that's where the power centers were the states. So what you had was all of the money going into the races for, state Senate, California be state assembly or state house as it is in Arizona, whatever your two state houses were, that's where all the money and corruption was going. And then that was a payoff-orama. Where I think of this for California, where you have, the public employees union controlling the state of California. Well, who do you think are going to be the two senators that the state of California is going to pick? The state legislature in California is so left, is so off the rocker. Now, remember, they were not that way, 100 years ago, but they are that way now. And so if they were getting that right, you can only imagine who they would be picking. They'd be picking probably leaders of the unions to go now be the senators. The good side is that would be offset by the other 98 senators. So you didn't have the problem really at the U.S. Senate level. You had it within the states, and the states were so fed up with the corruption and with the money going there and all the money going into who was going to be a U.S. senator, that's what was the impetus to changing this. The problem was is they didn't really look forward on this. So they took a corruption problem that was happening because all of a sudden you had millionaires. Remember, all of a sudden you had John Rockefeller and others who are now making these huge amounts of money and being able to put it into politics. You had political machines like the beginnings of the Pendergast machine in Kansas City that were able to put people into office, etc. So you had to deal with that problem, but they didn't foresee that as millionaires had millions as compared to the rest of the folks, they were simply going to pay now for U.S. senators. They were going to pay now for House members. They were going to ultimately, as we see now, pay for presidents. I mean, keep in mind how much money was spent last time. Kamala Harris, we talk about $1.3 billion, but it's really closer to about $1.8 billion. Trump spent about $600, $700 million. Where is all that coming from? So you're always going to have this problem of money in politics unless you change laws and really at the Supreme Court level. That doesn't change. And so for the rest of it, they also didn't see that as the federal government gained strength, all that was going to happen is now you have a federal income tax. Now you have, you know, federalized senators. It doesn't matter where you go. Those problems of corruption are not solved by simply changing what size ball you use in your game. It doesn't make any difference. So they didn't have the long-term vision there to see what the harm was going to be. They just simply said, like the Patriot Act, well, we have a problem. Here's an immediate solution. And of course, people like voting, and they shouldn't. And why should they not? Why should I not want to vote for my U.S. senator? I don't want to because of federalism, because I understand this. But I understand that most people are, you know, enjoy this. We've been doing this for an awfully long time, over 100 years, and it feels like a normal part of the process. And as a result, nobody, unlike Prohibition, nobody ever came back and examined this to say, well, wait a minute, did this really get us where we want to go? And has this created far more problems than good? And of course, what we argue, what James and I argue, is it really has created far more problems than good, and you're seeing the fruits of them. And I think when we come back from the next break, I think the Colonel and I are going to talk about the great American divorce that we see going on here and how it plays into this whole problem of federalism.
Yeah, we are. You know, you were talking about the money thing. You know, it's much easier to manage money at the state level because most of it's going to be localized or come from a limited set of sources. And then when we elevated it up to the federal level, now all of your senators are controlled by the same small group of big money entities, whether it be a person, a family, corporations, non-government organizations, government feeding tax dollars into non-government organizations like USAID did. I mean, the problem is much greater now that we've taken this on, and we'll talk specifics about that after this break. More with John Thaler, co-author of Restore the Senate. I've been talking about this for a long time, ever since before I ran for U.S. Senate, that we need to get back to the states being represented by the senators and not just another pack of voters, because the voters have our reps in the U.S. House of Representatives. That's why they're every 2-year cycles. That's why, because they're supposed to be closest to the people, and the senators are supposed to be representing the states. We'll be right back.
Friends, this is Brandon House. For more than a year now, I've been teaching through the book of Revelation, and the response from you has been overwhelming. You've asked me again and again, when are you going to put this study in print? We want to mark it up. We want to share it with our families. Well, it's here. My brand new 2-volume commentary on the book of Revelation, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. This is not a watered down, allegorized replacement theology approach to Revelation. This is a literal, grammatical, historical study, the way the Lord intended his word to be read. And I connect the prophecy of Revelation to the headlines you're watching unfold right now, the rise of global government and the convergence of end time events the Lord Jesus warned us about. Folks, we are living in serious days, and there has never been a more important time to understand what God has told us about what is coming. Get your 2-volume Revelation commentary today at worldviewstore.com. That's worldviewstore.com.
Right, but for example, on the Health Committee, you have Senator Collins, Senator Murkowski. They've already raised concerns about RFK Jr., I think. When you have Matt Gaetz, there's already some Republicans who have spoken out and said some things. The numbers start to get problematic if that is a problem, and your onus for you is to try to get the president who he wants to be in the cabinet. Do you then punt to a recess and try to recess the Senate for 10 days and get those appointments in?
Well, it's an option, but obviously it takes, you have to have all Republicans vote to recess as well. So the same Republicans that you mentioned that might have a problem voting for somebody under regular order probably also have a problem voting to put the Senate into recess. You have to have concurrence from the House. There's a process. All this is a process. But I don't think any of those things are necessarily off the table. I think we have to have all the options on the table. And these nominees deserve their day in court. They deserve a hearing, a confirmation hearing, an opportunity to be vetted. And the Senate will perform its constitutional role under advice and consent. But we are not going to allow the Democrats to thwart the will of the American people in giving President Trump the people that he wants in those positions to implement his agenda.
When it comes,
welcome back to the Rob Manis Show. It's Truth Thursday, and we're talking with one of the authors of the new book, Restore the Senate, Attorney John Thaler, in the show today. And it's all about the U.S. Senate. That was Majority Leader Thune of the U.S. Senate. And the Senate now is obstructing a president of the United States more than just the policy legislation. They're actually holding pro forma sessions so they don't go into recess, so he can't do recess appointments. This organization is broken compared to what the founders envisioned, isn't it?
It is entirely broken, and this is unfortunate. I think it's unfortunate, however, on both ends. As much as the Senate is broken, you know, some of this is also that the president did not make a number of appointments early on. One of the areas where he did not is in U.S. Attorney. So he's relied on a number of temporary appointments, acting appointments, et cetera, some of which are somewhat violative of the rules about doing so. But, you know, he could have put up, there are roughly 93 U.S. attorneys. He could have, if he wanted to change them out, all of them or part of them, he could have put them up for nomination. And yes, that's difficult. And yes, that's a lot of people. And yes, it takes up a lot of time in the U.S. Senate. But he decided not to do it. So he kind of put himself in the position of where you have to do recess appointments to get a lot of people into jobs. I think for most people, they don't really understand that it's not just the cabinet. There are so many positions that require the advice and consent of the U.S. Senate. On the other side of this, you know, I really, for the most part, I there's a lot of things about John Thune I like. I know he's not popular among a lot of Republicans, but there's a lot of things I like about him. But one of the things that absolutely, almost to the point of at this point, disgusts me is exactly this, that either you believe in Trump's agenda or you don't. And if you don't, that's one thing. Say so. Make it public. We can have a debate on that. But to kind of do it by this backdoor blocking of either recess appointments or just the ability to put forth judges just on the federal bench, we now have a vacancy on one of the federal appellate courts, is absolutely disgusting. You cannot get business done this way. And either the Senate's going to have to take up actual appointments and full hearings, because that's what the Senate is there to do, or it's going to have to allow the recess appointments, which for most people, if they don't know, last 2 years. So it doesn't last longer, but it'll last 2 years. You've got to do that to get this done. You cannot have a functioning federal government, a functioning executive branch, without at least some level of recess appointments, given the dysfunction that you have in the Senate and the House, even though the House doesn't decide these. But the dysfunction there on getting things done is so great, and the divide is so great. And, of course, in the Senate, the filibuster is so powerful in stopping, you know, people from being nominated and appointed, that you're going to have to do something else. So I don't really understand at this point what Thune is doing. If you really don't like what President Trump is doing, say that. Just say that. Come out and say you disagree, and come out and tell us why. And then we can have that debate, and the Republican Party can have that debate. And Republicans, as Ronald Reagan used to do, I don't know if people remember this, Ronald Reagan, anytime he wanted something passed, any legislation at all, where there was any question about its passage, got on TV, told the American people what he wanted to do and why he wanted to do it. And he said, call your congressman, call your senator, tell them to stand with this administration. So, you know, this is getting to the point where I hate to say it because I don't like the term, but you're either for us or you're against us. And if you're going to be against us, say why. Stop playing these silly games, these silly procedural games to stop the agenda.
Yeah, I appreciate the Reagan reference, but I mean, Donald Trump does that on steroids. Because now he has social media, he's on television, he's at rallies, and every single time,
William Maynard,
every single time, he talks about the SAVE Act, the Save America Act, I think is what it's called, and that over 80% of the American people, including Democrats, need that to be there. They matter of fact, most people, if you polled them and asked them this question, why did you want Donald Trump to be president again, in spite of all of the craziness? I bet you they would say to fix our election.
Yeah. Well, and certainly from someone like me and my other book, you know, Report to the Governor, I mean, that's one of the key issues for me is fixing elections. And of course, you know, one of the things we talk about in Report to the Governor is the disaster of mail-in balloting, how fraudulent it's become, why it's become this way, how easily it's controlled. And one of the things that you see, especially between 2020 and 2024, is the number of mail-in ballots versus the result. The number of mail-in ballots that were counted in 2024 was about a third of what came in 2020. And yes, we had a COVID problem. And yes, some of this was because we had to take some extreme measures. I get it. But the difference here is night and day. You know, Trump wins every one of the battleground states versus not only losing those states, but losing states like Arizona, where we have proved that fraud made a difference in that race. May have made a difference in many of the other ones, but in Arizona for sure, that 11,400 difference in vote count was because of the fraud within mail-in ballots. And when you see what goes on in California, you know, and then you get Gavin Newsom and others going on the air and saying, oh, it's a travesty. This is fine. You're messing with our elections. We have free and fair elections. In my 2007 book, The Decline and Fall of California, and in the new edition I'm doing a book called Revisiting That Book, which will be out in the fall, just in time for the election. You know, we talk about this in the second chapter of the book calls California, it's titled A Most Undemocratic State. You want to make your state undemocratic, use mail-in ballots. So, you know, the SAVE Act, there are things about it I like. There's things about it I don't like so much. It does have certain difficulties for some people, for sure. Are there other ways we might have tackled that? Maybe. But the bigger issue to me is not even the ID matters. But to me, it's not even just the ID. It's the fact that you can have mail-in ballots sent to everybody like they are in California. Mm-hmm. By the way, I haven't been a resident of California since 2011. I still get a mail-in ballot from California. Yeah. It's so bad, it's so notoriously evil that if you do not do something to solve for that problem and then solve again for the vote count, we're waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on this. You'll probably it'll be tomorrow. But the vote count problem of you can vote for this, you know, a week later, a month later, California allows 30 days for a ballot to come in. Is the mail system this bad that you can actually postmark your ballot on the day of the election, but a month later it comes in? I mean, it's an absurdity, and yet it's allowed, and it's absolutely positively not just killing elections, but more importantly, killing our confidence in them. And when you live in a federalist system, when you live in one where we are voting for representatives to then vote for us on what we want, how we want it, it is about as undemocratic as you get.
But the left wants democratic. They want democracy. So explain to folks real quick, John, the difference between what was intended and this democracy that the left keeps talking about. Although we have a democratic republic, I get it and all that stuff, but there are two distinctly different things. I think one of our founders said something to the effect that a democracy is two wolves and a sheep at lunch, and the wolves are trying to decide,
who gets
how they're going to eat him.
Look, democracy is a really fascinating concept. There really aren't true democracies in too many places, except for the fact of voting sometimes for leadership does sometimes do that. But even in Britain, for example, you know, you're voting for party, you know, the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, you're voting for the party. And then you know who the person's going to be, you know, who's going to be in charge, but you're not voting for Keir Starmer. You're voting for the Labour Party, and then the Labour Party is telling you who that leader is going to be and who's going to be in charge. In the United States, when we created this United States, states had independence. It was extraordinarily important that you did not change that. One of the reasons, by the way, was the opposite of what people think, freedom of religion. States were founded by different religions. And the whole concept here was that, you know, the religion, you know, the Quakers in Pennsylvania were going to be different than the Methodists, which were going to be different than the Baptists, which were going to be different than the Presbyterians and different from the Lutherans, et cetera, and certainly different from the Jews. It was going to be different. And those differences in moral clarity, in view of the world, in child rearing, even in families. in how you operated, how you did things, how you conducted business were different from state to state because of how they were founded and how they were developed. And so we couldn't have a democracy. You couldn't have a tyranny of the majority. You had to have a system where states had a say, where you certainly had different way of doing things within your state, but the states with respect to the federal government had to have their way. And the problem was, again, like with the Electoral College, is that you ran this risk that only a few concentrated areas of the country, obviously a majority is a majority, but where you'd have concentrated areas of the country determining what everyone else in the country did. So, you know, you'd have New York and California determining what happens in Missouri and Arkansas, except Missouri and Arkansas are not California and they're not New York. We wanted to preserve this independence and the differences. We live, you know, viva la difference. We live the differences. You know, and again, it goes back to something that's on all of our coins and on all of our money. E pluribus unum. Out of many, we are one.
That's right.
That's what it meant. It didn't mean democracy. It meant that we celebrate the differences, that we learn from and experience and enjoy these differences. So as you said before, if I don't like what's going on in California and 800,000 people a year don't, I can move from that state and go somewhere where I do like it. That's what this was supposed to be all about. You can't have that if you have population concentrations deciding what the rest of the country can and cannot do. That's exactly what democracy would be. It would be a tyranny of the majority. And it's exactly antithetical and heretical to our Constitution, to the rights that are in the Bill of Rights. And so as we come up on a 250-year, you know, anniversary of this country's founding and of the Bill of Rights, that's what people should understand. These individual rights only make sense if the majority cannot take them away from you. And that's the danger we're running with the socialists, with what's going on in New York, and what's going on with the Democrat Party. That's really the danger we're facing.
That's exactly right. And we were designed to not have to face it. We got to get back to that. I agree with you guys' thesis and premise in the book. How can folks find the book?
The book is available on Amazon. It is available both on a Kindle edition and, of course, the softcover edition. We may make a hardcover edition available if people want it, but we think the softcover edition works just fine. It is also available. We have a website for this, as we often do, restoringthesenate.com, restoringthesenate.com. You can go there and not only see a number of things about myself and about James R. and about Pirate Radio. We'll be back on the air starting on Friday. We've had a little hiatus for the summer, for the beginning of the summer, but we're going to be back on Friday. People can find out about us, find out about the book. They can read some sections from the book, and they can not only order it there, but they can order autographed copies with both James and I will be autographing and sending out. We already have a number of orders. We should be getting those out within the next week or two, but that's a great place to order it and find out more about us and more about the book, and it's great to take a look at before you buy. We hope you all do.
Well, thanks, John. I appreciate it. Appreciate your time. We will see you later. I'm sure you'll be back on the show. All right, folks. Remember, the 250th is coming up next week. I will see you on July 6th. We will be celebrating and doing some business up in the Washington, D.C. area. And remember your ancestors. Mine, William Manus, was a private in the Continental Army, the North Carolina line. They had just defeated the British invasion of Sullivan's Island around Charleston and are holding positions as the British flee to the north. That's what's happening today in my ancestors' life 250 years ago. Remember them because they are the reason why we have the chance to talk about this right now and do something about it. And you can get my book, What You Can Do About It, at Amazon and at robmanus.com, and the bonus chapters at robmanus.com, and it's free. I'll see you on the July 6th, more Monday, here on the Rob Manus Show.
This is Brandon Howe.